Who won the war and who initiated the peace? Our Reformation Society has, in South Africa, for the last 13 years, been seeking week by week to understand our history, our heritage, studying the people, the doctrines, the events that God used in the past, and to work for a better future. Frontline Fellowship, our mission, has been for 37 years serving persecuted churches. I've been a missionary for longer than that because my first mission was Hospital Christian Fellowship. That's where I was mentored and trained. My first mission field was the Army. And when I came out of the military, I started Frontline Fellowship. So we've been going 37 years. I've ministered in 37 countries in four continents, as far across Africa as the Congo, Sudan, Nigeria, and many other places in between. Who won the war? Who initiated the peace? As South Africa marked 20 years since the one man, one vote elections in South Africa, so I'm talking about back now in 2014, we were marking the 20th anniversary. We were subjected to an extraordinary amount of propaganda, inverting reality and rewriting history. If you were to take films like Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom, and I doubt if many of you have taken the time or bothered to see it. I had to see it. This Ted Baer of Movie Guide wanted me to do a review, and good thing I did a review on it, because that really, as they timed the coming out of the film with taking Mandela off the machine and saying he died. In fact, he was brain dead for 6 months before they announced his death, because they're still building things and they want the film to come out to coincide. I had a lot of opportunities to try and put the record straight. But if you take films, propaganda films, which Harvey Weinstein paid for, by the way, it's a Weinstein production, the Mandela Long Walk to Freedom. If you take it at face value, and the news commentary and documentaries we get on our SATV or Satanic Altar Television, it would appear that the ANC won the war and they were gracious and merciful to the defeated enemies. That's the impression you'd get if you are just paying attention to what the world's saying. In fact, the reverse is true. There can be no doubt that the South African Defence Force won the war. As a military force, the ANC's Umkhonto we Sizwe, or Spear of the Nation, MK, was a failure. In fact, this official history book of theirs, the cover, is embarrassing. This is so obviously posed, and there's not a bit of dirt in this uniform. This person hasn't done any push-ups, leopard crawling. This is like as posed and as embarrassing. And by the way, you didn't even get that type of grass up there anyway. I mean, this is taken in a trance guide. There's nothing in Angola or Southwest Africa looked like this. And so too was the Pan-African Congress, the PAC, the same terrorist attack, the St. James Church, which Charles shot back at. They were also a total military failure. Yes, they did manage some high-profile terrorist attacks, such as the Church Street bombing, which killed 19 people, 20th of May 1983. Horrific. That was Nelson Mandela's Umkhonto we Sizwe. He started Umkhonto we Sizwe, and in his book, Long Walk to Freedom, he said he signed off on it and he supported the Church Street bombing. 19 dead, more than 200 injured. And the St. James Massacre, which the Pan-African Congress terrorists machine-gunned people in a congregation, killed 11, injured and crippled 55. But they were never able to defeat the South African Defence Force in public, in battle. In fact, they could only operate as terrorist organizations planting landmines. Limpet mines, suitcase bombs, car bombs. These sort of posters were out almost anywhere to help people to visualize. In every shopping center, you'd see it to identify the different types of Soviet weaponry which the ANC were using. This is their tactics. Anti-personnel mine, anti-vehicle mine, grenades, and, of course, the other kind of bombs, grenades, the limpet mines. That's the sort of thing they might stick under a vehicle. And then the limpet mines, which you might attach to the side of any metallic object. They engaged in necklace murders and assassinations. Every time the SADF attacked, the guerrillas, the freedom fighters, the terrorists were defeated and the survivors fell. This picture you might pick up. It shows Cubans training their ANC terrorists in the field. So you got Cubans trying to teach them fire and movement. It didn't work. This is also true for SWAPO, Southwest African People's Organization in Southwest Africa, what today is called Namibia. And of course, they did a lot of their fighting in Angola. This is what they look like. They had a lot of good weapons given by the Soviet Union, very good weaponry. The Soviets really supplied them well. And they had But if they drop mortars on our bases, they would have as many mortars in the air as possible, and before the first one fell, they were fleeing. They'd just leave the mortar plate, and they'd running, because they knew the moment the bombs fell, we would be triangulating, and they'd be replying, and follow-ups would be, and they were running, but we still caught them, and they didn't get away. This is what was the standard weapon. They planted a lot of landmines in the roads. However, South African soldiers traveled in armored cars. So if our vehicles hit it, our people probably survived. But the civilians, the farmers, the farm workers, they were in soft-skin vehicles. They were the victims of the landmines. This is the tools of terror, the devil's seed, landmines. In a 26 years terrorist war, SWAPO managed to murder 10,000 civilians in Southwest Africa, much of them by landmines. This is what a van, a combi, used to look like, or what it looks like afterwards. What happens to a pickup truck when it hits a landmine? This, who knows what it was? Actually, it was some kind of farm truck. And of course, people get mangled too in these landmine explosions. This is the hard reality. Notice the hands tied with wire. Burning buses, car bombs in Windhoek, the capital city's shopping center. That's where the car bomb was. And suitcase bomb in a shop, suitcase bomb in a butchery, a suitcase bomb with a limpet mine in a post office in Ndangwa. However, they were not able to hold any ground in Southwest Africa, and their external bases in Angola were protected by Cuban, Soviet, MPLA, FAPLA forces, but every time the SADF attacked, they were destroyed. They never managed to stand. They could never stand. They always fled. In fact, when operations took place, for example, if I just take 6 South African infantry, first operation that our unit 6SAR was involved in was to be stop groups for Operation Smokeshell. 1980, South African Air Force came in, bombed this terrorist headquarters in Angola. The paratroopers dropped. But of course, by the time the paratroopers reached the base, there were no terrorists there. They'd fled. And so our infantry had been placed north as stop groups and got most of the kills because they all fled, but they fled right into the guns of the SADF that was pre-positioned there. These are our paratroopers on the ground. Angolan T-55 tank captured by our army. Even when they dug their tanks in, because they're so scared of getting hammered, they still got hammered. At the height of the Cold War from 1985 to 1988, the South African Defense Force faced increasing confrontations with Soviet MiG fighter bomber jets and with Mi-24 hind helicopter gunships. This is the kind of Soviet weaponry we were facing. Russian MiG-17s, MiG-21, Mi-24 hind helicopter gunships. These are the worst. We've been strafed and bombed by these. These are like flying tanks. Absolutely devastating. And it's for this reason that the South Africans designed the Roy Falk helicopter, which America imported from South Africa, and you call it the Apache. The Russian MiG-29s, they were the most advanced we had to face. We were strafed by them. And on our side, we had Second World War vintage C-47s, or we call them DC-3s. I've traveled in these quite a few times. Our old Sabres that we were using in the Korean War. Our Impalas, these are the main ground attack aircraft. And then the Mirages, these came from France, but we greatly upgraded them, and they were called Cheetahs, the Mark IIIs. We upgraded the weapon systems dramatically. The Puma helicopter. This is the South African Roy Falk, which I think you call the Apache, a ground attack weapon designed by South Africa to counter the Mi-24 hind helicopter gunships in Angola. And in operation, these are absolutely deadly. I've seen a Roy Falk go up against a hind and win. They were every bit the equal, and in hands of good pilots, they were superior to the Mi-24s. This is what we'd see in Ndangwa, the bunkers prepared, ready for first strike response. And here's our Mirages. These are the Cheetahs, Mirage 3s, heading off to intercept. And tremendous payload, phenomenal power force. Now, of course, these are quite old weapons. We're talking about 1980s, but at that time, this was the best we had. And this, these are the Mirage 3s. All of them would be called cheetahs. And you can see from the top how good the camouflage could be. Blue from underneath, if you're looking up, camouflage from above. And this is one of these nice sidewinders. And there's a whole lot of dogfights. I know of at least 19 dogfights that took place between South African Mirages and MiGs, and our people won all of them. And they're all documented, and we've got the online cameras, and there's some books written on the dogfight techniques and how our people took out the Russians. And these were Soviet Air Force, Cuban Air Force. These are the sort of news. This is 1982, for example. I think that's the first time we shot down a MiG was 82. And here you can see Mi-24 Hind helicopter gunship taken out. And this is an Mi-8 HIP helicopter being taken out by South African Impala. We faced massive ground offensives by Cuban MiGNAS divisions in Angola. And this is often how we would be delivered into the area. This is the Puma helicopters. And on the ground, that's the kind of backpacks. We would carry roughly 58 pounds of kit on average infantry digs. Now, as infantry. I never knew we had tanks. I never knew we had so many tanks until sometime in 1985, suddenly, you saw all these Olifants. It's basically the British Centurion upgraded. They suddenly appeared by the hundreds, and I didn't know where they came from. We'd never even knew we had tanks. We had armored cars. But suddenly the whole war got conventional. And from somewhere, South Africa's tank corps pitched up. We had the biggest tank battle seen since El Alamein, which my dad was involved in North Africa. These are G5s. These, America even purchased these from Arms Corps. Funny, after sanctioning South Africa weapons, America was buying ours because Saddam Hussein had bought them, and so you needed a counter. And these 155 howitzers, the G5s we call them, were just the best artillery piece. They can even deliver tactical nukes. Not that they did, but they could. And range is phenomenal. G5 in action. It's a 155 howitzer. And I'll show you in a moment. This is now a 5.5 inch. This is really old. This is actually Korean War old. But we were using that too. On every occasion, the SADF decisively defeated the Cuban and Soviet forces. General Yanni Heldnes, who once was head of the South African Army and later head of the South African Defense Force, wrote in his book, We Were There, Winning the War for Southern Africa. He documented the enormous Soviet mobilization in Angola and the staggering losses they endured at the hands of the South African Defense Force. Unlike many other generals, he was on the front. We would see General Heldnes and his predecessor, General Viljoen, would be in the front. In fact, I saw General Viljoen way behind the lines, 100 and something kilometers north of the border into Angola. There's the chief of the army turning up at the front and behind the lines even. He quotes from Soviet Lieutenant Colonel Igor Zadorkin, who is a participant in the Angolan War. This is Zadorkin, one of his books that he contributed to, frontline accounts by Soviet soldiers. Zadorkin's book, We Did Not See It, Even in Afghanistan, published by the Russian Academy of Science Institute for Africa Studies, attributes the fall of the Soviet Union to the ripple effects of the disastrous defeats suffered by the Russians and their Cuban allies in Angola at the hands of the South African Defense Force. They put there, we knew we could not win a nuclear war with the West, but we thought we could at least win a conventional war. But when we could not even win a conventional war against South African Army in Angola, we concluded we had no chance against NATO. We did not see it even in Afghanistan. Written Russian, English translation there. Here's one of the pictures of him, somewhere near Quetta Carnaval. We wouldn't have been far away from him in 1987. Could have been just a few kilometers away. He also quotes from Jozsa Mahlisa's book, Angola, The Beginning of the End of the Soviet Union. Now, Jozsa Mahlisa is of Portuguese origin, but he is based in Russia. His first book's title was called The End of the Soviet Union. And his second book, republishing the same book, but a new title, Angola, The Beginning of the End of the Soviet Union. Now, of course, we know that there was a lot of other things on the go. Solidarity in Poland. There was Contras in Nicaragua, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, RENAMO in Mozambique, which we were also involved in. There's a lot going on, but the fact is the Soviet Union was facing defeats all over the place. And there was, it was part of a comprehensive plan, which, of course, Ronald Reagan was integrally involved in. But our part was taking them on at the hottest part of the Cold War, the sharp end, the war in Angola, which was the high watermark of the Soviet Union. Carlos Pacheco, a Brazilian historian who wrote the preface to Mahalia's book, The Fracas of Soviet Expansionism, concludes, by the way, this picture is taken in Angola, in Luanda Harbor, head of the Russian Navy, head of the Russian military, coming to Angola to visit their most important front. This Soviet warship was in Luanda Harbor, in Angola, right on our border. The first priority of the Soviet expansionism in Southern Africa was not so much important in terms of materials, but all about politics. He emphasized that it was the Republic of South Africa that the Soviets had their sights on. Angola was only a stepping stone towards a mineral-rich, strategic South Africa. And you can see the tanks and trucks coming out the side of this. Well, it may look like a commercial freighter, but it's obviously military application. Russian tanks in the roads of, in this case, Huambo in Angola, second largest city in Angola. Cuban troops marching in Luanda, capital of Angola. Soviet missiles in Angola. You were quite unhappy about Soviet missiles in Cuba. Well, Angola was pretty close to us too. Uncle Fidel visiting his new colony. And this man next to him, Agostinho Neto, the first dictator of Angola, he was described by the CIA as a drunken, psychotic Marxist poet. Neto said, within 20 years, you won't find a Bible in Angola. I've destroyed the Bible. You will have to go to a museum to see what a Bible looks like. Well, our mission smuggled more Bibles into Angola than there was when he made that stupid false prophecy. By the way, you notice the Cuban flag next to the Angolan flag up there. Cuba colonized Angola. That's the only word for it. They had 650,000 troops pass through there. There were 55,000 troops at any one time in Angola during the 14 years of Cuban involvement there. Cubans were in 13 countries in Africa, as far as Ethiopia, Sudan, Guinea-Bissau, Equatorial Guinea, all sorts of places. The Cubans were all over Africa as the proxies for the Soviet Union. This is a picture taken by our troops during Operation Smokeshell, north of the border, raiding on them. Now, these pictures, I must admit, were not there. They were placed there for this photograph. They're off the walls. But Brezhnev, Datsus, Castro, you see two South African troops there. There's an officer with a beret and there's a normal soldier. And there's a P-76, an amphibious Soviet tank. Swapo posters, Russian rank posters and so on. And then here's a picture captured showing two Soviet officials lecturing Swapo terrorists in Angola. And notice the Vietnamese flag behind. Dos Santos, the dictator of Angola at the time. And here's the Marx brothers, Karl Marx, Frederick Engels, Vladimir Lenin. It just showed, the Soviets were fully, fully involved in Angola. Chester Crocker, the United States Secretary of State for Africa, in his book High Noon in Southern Africa, Making Peace in a Rough Neighborhood, he wrote, in early October 1987, now the reason why I'm quoting him is it's no good South Africans blowing their own trumpet. It's better if our enemies say it's for us. That's why I'm quoting what the Soviets said and so on. So Chester Crocker, not a friend of ours, said, in early October 1987, the Soviet FAPLA offensive, FAPLA is the armed forces of the Communist Party of Angola, was smashed at the Lomba River near Mavinga. It turned into a headlong retreat over the 120 miles back to the primary launching point at Quito Carnaval. In some of the bloodiest battles of the entire Civil War, a combined force of some 8,000 UNITA freedom fighters, UNITA, the Union for the Total Liberation of Angola, Jonas Savimbi's freedom fighters that we ministered amongst and did chaplaincy work for, UNITA, 8,000 UNITA, 4,000 South African Defense Force troops, our people, destroyed a FAPLA brigade and mauled several others out of a total FAPLA force of some 18,000 engaged in a three-pronged offensive. This, by the way, is an example of what one South African G5, that's 155mm howitzer, direct hit does to a Soviet tank. Lifts, can you imagine a force that lifts a 65-ton tank up in the air, brings it down its back, with the torrents and the tracks spread all over the place. That is a direct hit. Estimates, I'm still quoting from Chester Crocker, estimates of FAPLA losses ranged upwards of 4,000 killed and wounded. The offensive had been a Soviet conception from the beginning, from start to finish, and senior Soviet officers played a central role in its execution. Over 1,000 Soviet advisors were assigned to Angola in 1987. 1,000. In fact, do you know that the Russian Spetsnaz people, that's the special forces, list 800 Spetsnaz killed in action in Angola. That's a lot for special forces. To help with Moscow's largest logistical effort to date in Angola, roughly $1.5 billion, that's 1987 money, $1.5 billion in military hardware was delivered that year to Angola. In fact, the Soviets have got, or the Russians these days have got, memorial for those who fought in Angola, and this is their campaign medals and the different flags. Of course, the Soviet Union's flag, Russia's flag, Angola's Communist Party flag, Agostino Neto, and so on and so forth. And this is where we're doing our fights. Kwanda, Kabongo provinces, where we did a lot of our work in the Kuneni province. Here's Soviet military advisors in Angola. And by the way, those are the first multiple grenade launchers that the world had ever seen. We captured them in 1980 on Smokeshall. Jane's Defense Weekly got their first stats from South African Colonel Des Radmore, who did all the specs on these, and when we captured the first SAM missiles as well in 1980, that ended up in Jane's Defense Weekly, courtesy of South African Army. Here's some Soviet officers encamped near the Lomba River during the Battle of Quito Carnaval. These are pictures that were captured. Huge quantities of Soviet equipment were destroyed or fell into UNITA and SADF hands when FAPLA broke into disorganized retreat. Notice the Soviet Cyrillic script, and notice the Chinese Cyrillic script on 82mm mortars and the 60mm mortars. These are some of the shopping expedition material looted and brought back. It is more blessed to give than to receive. And so these were given to UNITA freedom fighters to use in their fight to liberate the country. These are Strela Soviet heat-seeking missiles, surface-to-air. I'm still quoting from Chester Crocker. The 1987 military campaign represented a stunning humiliation for the Soviet Union, its arms, and its strategy. At one hostile press conference in Vintok, Colonel Dion Ferreira, he is the commanding officer of 3-2 Battalion at the time. 3-2 Battalion was made up of ex-communist, Angolan, Portuguese-speaking black people who came over the border and joined the South African Army. About 3,000 of them. Defected, joined us, fought for South Africa the whole way through the war. Dion Ferreira led them in ops, and he was also commander of ops modular Hooper and Packer, which included the mechanized units and infantry. So Colonel Dion Ferreira, as the operational commander, was challenged to respond to accusations that the South Africans had actually been beaten in the just concluded battles in Angola. Hostile press conference. He responded tongue-in-cheek, "If defeat for the South Africans meant the loss of 31 men, 3 tanks, 5 armored vehicles, and 3 aircraft, then we lost. If victory for FAPLA and the Cubans meant the loss of 4,600 men, 94 tanks, 100 armored vehicles, 9 aircraft, and other Soviet equipment valued at more than R1 billion, then they won." That's the kind of answer you'd expect from a 3-2 battalion commander. Facts are stubborn things, such as the fact that the Supreme Communist Commander of Angola, Cuban General Arnaldo Ocaña Sánchez, who was a personal friend and buddy from the earliest part of the revolution of Fidel Castro, was executed by firing squad less than a year later in Havana, Cuba, on express orders of His Excellency, the dictator Fidel Castro. You don't execute the commanding general of a victorious army. Not by the same side, anyway. I've walked through the graveyards of the Soviet tanks, armored cars, and shot-out equipment in Angola. I've many pictures of shot-out Soviet aircraft. Some crash-landed, others blown to pieces, like this Mi-24 helicopter gunship. And this Mi-24 helicopter gunship totally destroyed. And destroyed Soviet tanks and Cuban tanks in Angola, including from the actual operations themselves, Ops Modular, Ops Hooper, and also the graveyards of them since I mean, they just litter the landscape in Angola. Absolute destruction. There is no doubt about who won the war in Angola. Here's the banks of the Lomba River. The dismantled Iron Curtain also makes clear who lost the Cold War. The Berlin Wall came down. By the way, I don't know if you know some interesting anecdote to this. Back in 1982, just before my first mission across the border into Mozambique, I was at my old mission of Hospital Christian Fellowship, and along came Brother Andrew, who I'd heard before, went into the army as well. Brother Andrew is a good friend of HCF. And he said, we are going to start a seven-year Jericho prayer march, prayer focus on bringing down the Iron Curtain, collapsing the Berlin Wall, and opening up Eastern Europe for the gospel, collapse the Soviet Union, all that. I sat there thinking, Brother Andrew's off his rocker, because I'd been to the Berlin Wall, I'd seen the Iron Curtain. It wasn't coming down in our lifetime. I mean, any of us back in those days, I was convinced it would be up till Jesus came back. I mean, it was a permanent fact of life back in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Iron Curtain, it's not coming down. 7 years later, after Leipzig prayer meetings had ignited in Eastern Europe, we weren't just praying for Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe was praying. People in Germany, and their symbol was the candle. All the darkness cannot put out the smallest light. And we saw the Iron Curtain come down. We saw the Berlin Wall come down. We saw the Soviet Union collapse. We saw the idols of Lenin taken down, thousands of them, and celebrations like you've never seen before at Berlin as they were reunited. And meanwhile, when we drive on missions to Angola, you can see the shot out remains. You can see the jungles reclaiming a lot of the BRDMs, armored cars. I mean, it's just junkyards of Soviet weaponry at the high water mark of the Soviet Union. You can Google Earth, Lomba River, and you can find there mountains of Soviet weaponry that you can just see on Google Earth from back home. Tangible evidence of the destruction of the Soviet weaponry in Angola. And as this book puts it, the day a South African armored battalion shattered Angola's last mechanized offensive, and it was the elite 47th Regiment, President, dictator, Fidel Castro's personal presidential guard mechanized division. They had the best of the best. And they were destroyed in a day. One day. Last hot battle of the Cold War. And General Heldenes documents it. Fred Bridgeland documents it. So several years ago, at this 20th anniversary of the liberation of South Africa, I had the opportunity to speak with F.W. de Klerk, the previous president of South Africa, the one who'd done the treacherous handover to the ANC. I asked, now, the reason why I was so polite to him that day was my daughter was singing in the Cape Town Youth Choir at a major event, and ex-president de Klerk's wife was a sponsor, and my daughter pleaded with me, Dad, don't embarrass me, please don't make a scene. She knew how much I loathed de Klerk, and the last time I'd met him, I'd refused to shake his hand, made up quite a scene, so I don't shake hands with the hands of people who've shaken hands with terrorists sort of attitude. Although I didn't say at the time, I was too angry to even think of the right words, but I kept my hands by my side while the president's hand was out, which horrified some people that I could be so rude. But anyway, so for the sake of my daughter, I decided, okay, if I can't tackle this man and tell him what I think of him, I'll use it for intelligence purposes. So I asked him if he had seen the Mandela Long Walk to Freedom film, and what he thought of how the negotiation process with him was depicted. De Klerk smiled and said no, he hadn't seen the film and he had no intention of seeing the film, and he's sure that the way it was depicted would not be accurate because it would be based on Mandela's biography, Long Walk to Freedom. So I then asked Mr. De Klerk if he could correct me if I'm wrong. Could you correct my perception? I said, we're continually being bombarded with disinformation that the ANC won the war and Mandela was gracious to his defeated enemies. I mean, that's the way it's often portrayed. I had always thought, I said, that the opposite was true. We had won the war and our government had chosen to be gracious with our defeated enemies. My understanding was after a series of stunning military victories in Angola, when we had thoroughly blunted and devastated the communist forces in Angola, with the Russians having withdrawn from Angola and the Cubans having been withdrawn, and as the Berlin Wall fell and the Iron Curtain collapsed, as one country after another throughout Eastern Europe overthrew the communist dictators who had oppressed them for decades, our government in South Africa had chosen to seize the initiative and initiate negotiations with the ANC and other black nationalist groups to seek to bring a peaceful resolution for all South Africans. At this, Mr. de Klerk nodded all the way through and he heartily agreed. He said, yes, that's true. We negotiated from a position of strength. The ANC had lost their Soviet sponsors and we saw an opportunity to seize the initiative and resolve our problems in South Africa by bringing about a constitutional state where the rule of law would guarantee the rights of all. That's what de Klerk said. Mr. Klerk then smiled and said, if we had wanted to, the National Party could still be the government of this country. I could still be its president, he told me in 2014. Then he added, however, that would have been at the cost of many more lives lost in the ongoing war. I replied that many South Africans would have gladly continued fighting communism and terrorism, especially as many more had died from crime since than had even died in the war. In fact, I said, I would have gladly continued to fight to this day. We lost, South African Army, we lost over 650 men killed in action in a 26-year war. We lose something in the region of 25,000 people murdered a year under the ANC South Africa. How on earth is this better than war? I know, said Mr. de Klerk, but apartheid had to go. We could not fight for an unjust cause. My response to him was, my understanding is that apartheid had already been rejected by white South African electorate in 1983 referendum. Most people forget this. I remember in 1983, when I was 23 years old, voting yes to a referendum to abolish apartheid. Now, I don't know if this is in anyone's history books, but it happened. White South Africans voted in 1983 to abolish apartheid. Apartheid was gone, in fact, long before that. When I was brought up in Rhodesia, there was no apartheid in Rhodesia. In Rhodesia, black people could come to white swimming pools, cinemas, restaurants. There was no problem. They had their areas, we had ours, but there was a certain amount of mixing and there was no law against that. And in fact, it worked quite well. The whites were conscripted into army in Rhodesia. Blacks volunteered and the Rhodesian army was 80% black. In South Africa, the whites were conscripted. Blacks volunteered. Whites were about 65% of the South African army. We were conscripted, but the 35% that were black were volunteers, like the Bushmen who had been hunted for sport and enslaved by the Avembos. And they happily joined the SADF to get their back on the Avembo to renounce the terrorists, you know. So we had all kinds, we had Zulus, we had all kinds of units in the army, but they were volunteers. But in Cape Town, where I live and where our mission headquarters is based, Cape Town started getting rid of apartheid in the 1970s, getting rid of separate beaches, getting rid of separate cinemas, same buses. There was no, so segregation had gone in Cape Town. Interesting enough, segregation first started to go in the South African Army. The South African Navy abolished apartheid in 1974. I was 14 then. The South African Police abolished apartheid in 1976. Same rank structure, same pay scales, same uniforms and so on. Already back, same, what do you call it, restaurants, the whole lot, mess. And the South African Army certainly had abolished apartheid by the time I got in there. When we got to, while we trained in our own units on the border, we would often be working together with integrated units like 3-2 battalion and so on. So there were times that I was in the army and I was being given an order by a colored or a black officer. And that was normal. And that was in the apartheid army. There was no more apartheid. Apartheid had been scrapped in the army. So officially, the politicians caught up years after the Navy, police and army, and they abolished apartheid in 1983. So when people speak about apartheid was abolished in 1994, they actually don't know what they're talking about. Apartheid had already been abolished in stages long before then. And certainly 83 is a watershed point when a majority of white voters voted to abolish apartheid. In fact, I said, now I'm continuing what I said to the clerk, I said, in fact, your predecessor, President P.W. Botha, had abolished virtually every apartheid law before 1989. We were not fighting for apartheid, we were fighting against communism, we were fighting against terrorism. That is true, said Mr. de Klerk. However, that's not the way the world saw it. Until they saw a black president over South Africa, they would not believe apartheid was abolished. That's what he said. I then said, Mr. de Klerk, do you believe that the ANC government has been true to the agreement negotiated by your government in 1994? No, they are not, he said. We agreed to a constitutional state where the rule of law applies without any regard to race. Mr. de Klerk, I responded, there are many who are looking to you to set the record straight and remind South Africans and the world what was negotiated and agreed to in 1994. And that's about the limit of what I could do without being embarrassing for my daughter, who was deeply concerned that her concert would not be ruined by her dad making a scene. So I was very polite to him, against my natural inclination. Mr. de Klerk thanked me, assured me he had endeavored to do so through the de Klerk Foundation. Now, he's what we call in South Africa a Volksverraier, a traitor. A traitor of the folk, a traitor of the people, Volksverraier. But he has at least gone on record and reminded the people that this is not what we negotiate for, and they're breaking the agreement and solemn international agreements and so on. We were at war. We agreed to peace in 94 on the basis of private ownership of property, farmlands, rule of law, no expropriation of any property without just compensation by market force. And that's part of the constitutional agreement. We stopped the war on the basis of a negotiated peace. Now, I don't think they should have, because as Vladimir Lenin said, treaties are like pie crusts made to be broken. To tell the truth is a petty bourgeois habit, but to lie convincingly is a sign of superior intelligence. That's what Vladimir Lenin said. How can you have agreements with pathological liars who boast about the ability to lie and deceive and believe lying is an art form to be refined? So plainly, they did the wrong thing. But I'm not trying to justify what our government did. I'm just explaining the fact that what they're doing now is violating solemn agreements that averted war. And if they violate these agreements, they open the door to a renewal of the war. Karl Marx declared the first battlefield is the rewriting of history. See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and the basic principles of this world rather than on Christ. We need to understand the Cold War context. You know, people talk about apartheid like it just happened. One day somebody woke up and said, I know what, let's make other people's life miserable. Let's come out with a whole bunch of laws. No, that's not the way it happened. There's a context. Everything has a context. If I show you a clip of a San Francisco policeman, Dirty Harry, shooting a person in the leg while he's running across a field and then stepping on that wounded leg while a man screams in agony, you may think, if you don't know the context, police brutality. But if you know the context that this is a kidnapper and there's a young girl in a confined space who's going to run out of oxygen very soon and who's dying of asphyxiation and he's trying to get the information to save life, that may put some context to it. If you just see the reaction without knowing the cause and the context, you could come to the wrong conclusion. If you don't understand the Cold War context, you can't understand South African history. It's impossible to understand South African history without understanding the Cold War and the very clear and present threat of Soviet expansionism and Soviet revolution. They wanted our minerals and the strategic Cape Sea route. To understand South African history, you need to understand the African context, the continent of Africa, the violence, the massacres, the lawlessness. This, by the way, is Idi Amin, brutal mass murderer of Uganda, who killed the Archbishop of the Anglican Church personally and cooked and ate his brains, liver, heart, and the rest of him. Absolute sadist. He was a Muslim dictator who made Islam the official religion of Uganda, even though Islam was only 6% of the population. And he butchered the people there, killed about 650,000. This is Emperor Bokassa, declared the poorest country in Africa, Central African Republic, the Central African Empire, had a coronation that cost more than the gross domestic product of his country, and so on. Liberation in Africa has normally meant some poor black man getting tied to a post and shot by a firing squad. That's freedom for many. Unless we understand the decolonization process, which led to violence, massacres, and lawlessness, this is what led South Africans to naturally attempt to ensure that such things never happened here. Rhodesian headmen shot by ZANU terrorists, Mugabe's terrorists. You have to understand the horror and the shock that was created by the vicious Mau Mau atrocities in Kenya in 1950s and the horrendous massacres in the Congo by the communist Simba terrorists in 1960s. If you don't understand the Simbas and the Mau Mau, you don't understand why we had laws to prevent that happening in South Africa. We were in a context. The continent of Africa was going mad. People were being butchered, tortured all over Africa. Nuns were being raped in the Congo. Christians and missionaries were being killed, sacrificed to Patrice Lumumba in open ceremonies in Stanleyville, for example. Until you understand that, you don't understand why the South Africans did what they did. You've got to understand the Soviet threat. The Cold War was an ever-present reality from the 1950s through to the end of the 1980s. The Soviet Union and Red China were arming and training Marxist revolutionaries throughout Africa. In 13 communist countries, tens of thousands of Cubans, troops, were propping up unelected Marxist dictators. There were horrific atrocities taking place in Portuguese East Africa and Portuguese West Africa, what today is Mozambique and Angola. I mean, the communist Frelimo campaign in Mozambique began with the decapitation of a Catholic priest in a church and desecrating an altar with his skull. In Angola, the Marxists, the MPLA, began the campaign with a massacre of 43 men, women, and children who were literally fed through buzzsaws at a timber mill. Can you understand the context in which South Africa brought about laws, suppression of Communism Act, Internal Security Act, and so on? They were there to try and prevent that happening here. The murder of whole families in Rhodesia, the landmine campaigns, the RPG and mortar attacks on farms, limpet mines and railway stations, shopping centers, car bombs in Church Street, Pretoria, the Kalahari Sands Hotel in Windhoek, murders of missionaries and their babies in Elim in Zimbabwe, the ANC terrorist attacks in Sasol, the Caltex oil refinery attacks in Cape Town, the attempt of the ANC to blow up Kubuk nuclear power station, which is in Cape Town. All were reminders we evolved in a hot part of the Cold War. The sharp point of the Cold War. That was the context, that was the reality. It is very dishonest of those reporting on South African OZS without recognizing the very real war we were involved in. The continent was aflame. I was brought up in Rhodesia, where the school teachers carried machine guns, where the roads we had to do our school outings on were endangered by landmines and ambushes, where the farms, when we visited relatives on a farm, were under siege. Sandbags by the windows, rifles by the door. Don't switch on the light without closing the curtains. Never go out the front door without switching off the lights behind you. Never frame yourself against the light. From a young age, as a little boy, as a primary school student, I knew those rules. That was reality. That's how we were brought up. And it's dishonest for people to ignore the very real danger of the wars, the landmines. Now, Senator Jeremiah Denton, who spent time in a communist hellhole in Hanoi Hilton himself, he chaired the Subcommittee on Security and Terrorism in 1982, Soviet, East German, and Cuban involvement in fomenting terrorism in Southern Africa. And in here, a lot of the testimony gets from Bartholomew Klopane. Bartholomew Klopane was a senior Politburo of the Southern Communist Party who testified that Nelson Mandela was a senior Politburo member of the Southern Communist Party as well. And he said, there is nothing we can do in the ANC or the Southern Communist Party where the orders don't come from the KGB, from Moscow, from the Kremlin. We are completely under their control. He also testified that Joe Slova, the handler of Nelson Mandela, was a KGB colonel and so on and so forth. Now, Bartholomew Klopane returned to South Africa and later that year was murdered along with his wife in Soweto by AK-47 wielding M. Kontawisizwe terrorist thugs. His daughter, Pansy Klopane, was paralyzed from the neck down, confined to a wheelchair the rest of her life. In 1987, I took Pansy Klopane, I was pushing her wheelchair to Kirchentag, Church Day in Frankfurt, Germany, where we were going to speak out against the German government's support for the ANC and for SWAPO, and to speak at this church conference where we knew the ANC would be, and to say, this is, Pansy wanted to give a testimony. She's 18 years old at the time, on how her parents had been murdered 5 years earlier. I saw communist thugs in Germany shaking boxes of matches in Pansy's face. 18-year-old paraplegic girl in a wheelchair. We'll necklace you. You're going to be burned alive when you come back to South Africa. Can you imagine people doing that? Because her dad told the truth. We read in Romans 3, their deeds are evil deeds. Acts of violence are in their hands. Their feet rush into sin. They are swift to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are evil thoughts. Ruin and destruction mark their ways. The way of peace they do not know. There is no justice in their paths. They have turned them into crooked paths. No one who walks in them will know peace. The New World Order worked hard at destroying those states attempting to uphold Christian values. I mentioned to you, Christian values we had in the South African Army. Pornography was illegal in the whole country. Blasphemy was illegal. The Last Temptation of Christ was banned in South Africa, one of the few countries in the world to ban it. We had standards. Bible in schools, Bible in the army, and all the rest of it. No wonder the West hated us. It wasn't because of apartheid. It was because we loved Christ. Same with Rhodesia. They attacked our countries not because of our internal policies. Like, since when did the US government care about people in other countries? Do they care about the tens of millions of slaves in China? From where all your Disney toys and McDonald's toys are made? Probably by Christian slaves in concentration camps. Do they care for the people in the sweatshops of Indonesia where they farm out American jobs to and so on? They don't care for the people in North Korea or anywhere else where they've sold those countries in the hands of communist dictators. No, I don't believe that any of these social justice warriors' moral outrage is genuine, because I think they're all a bunch of hypocrites. Hence the extraordinary international campaigns against Rhodesia and against South Africa in the 60s, 70s, and the 80s. You've got to see Satan's strategy here. Many South Africans recognize we have a great calling, a great responsibility. We're in the midst of a great conflict. Vladimir Lenin declared, whoever controls the tip of Africa controls the world. We want it for international communism. When I was entering the South African Army, this was the reality. Even my home country of Rhodesia was under the communist control. This is South Africa's border. We were surrounded by the frontline states, Angola, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, surrounding and threatening us. They were in Madagascar, they're in Ethiopia, all over Asia, of course, over in Cuba, close to your shores. One third the world's population and land surface was under the direct control of Moscow or Peking. In the Battle for Africa, Brother Andrew explained, the South African church is one of tremendous devotion to Christ. It has the spiritual muscle and the financial resources to reach Black Africa. I believe Satan is aware that South Africa has this potential and consequently works hard to isolate South Africa from the rest of the world. It has been singled out for boycott, embarrassment, and criticism, particularly, I believe, because Satan wants to isolate South Africa to prevent it from fulfilling its divine commission. South Africa is a major missionary-sending country. And they hate us. The defeat of the Soviet forces in Angola, Afghanistan, Nicaragua, and the tidal wave of opposition to communism that swept Eastern Europe in 1989 brought an end to the Soviet control of Eastern Europe and the collapse of the Soviet Union itself. And that opened the way for ending the wars throughout the whole of Southern Africa. And as soon as the Cubans left and the Soviets fell, suddenly we could have elections in Mozambique and Angola and Zambia and places where it had never been possible before. This resolved conflicts which had raged throughout the Cold War throughout Africa. The Soviet Union communism was plainly behind these conflicts, and once the Soviet threat was removed, all these countries managed to secure internal settlements of one sort or another. Here you can see just some of the South African Air Force varieties. It was after the South African Defense Force's decisive military victories in the field that the National Party decided to release Mandela, a mistake, I believe, but that was their decision, and other ANC and Communist Party revolutionaries from prison. in the hopes of bringing about negotiations that would end the violence and the international isolation against South Africa. To be honest, the main concern was that we could participate in Olympics in Barcelona in 1992 and play rugby and football against Australia and New Zealand in particular. I mean, that honestly was the main reason. We gave our country up for a couple of ball games. This is quite the reverse of what the state media and the school textbooks would have us believe. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Have you ever argued with people like this? Their minds are just full of slogans. Acquitting the guilty and condemning the innocent, the Lord detests them both. General Sir Walter Walker, when he was head of NATO, visited the South African army bases in the border to evaluate us, and he quoted from the creator of Sherlock Holmes. You all know the name of this would be Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So Arthur Conan Doyle wrote the book, The Great Boer War. And in this book, he quoted, and this is the quote that Sir Walter Walker, head of NATO, quoted in the 80s when I was up at the border. Take a community of Dutchmen of the type of those who defended themselves for 50 years against all the power of Spain, at a time when Spain was the greatest power in the world. Intermix them with the strain of those inflexible French Huguenots who gave up home and fortune and left their country forever at the time of the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. The product must obviously be one of the most rugged, virile, unconquerable races ever seen upon earth. Take this formidable people and train them for seven generations in constant warfare against savage men and ferocious beasts in circumstances under which no weakling could survive. Place them so that they acquire exceptional skill with weapons and in horsemanship, and give them a country which is eminently suited to the tactics of the huntsman, the marksman, and the rider. Then finally, put a finer temper upon their military qualities by a dour, fatalistic Old Testament religion and an ardent, consuming patriotism. Combine all these qualities and all these impulses in one individual, and you have the modern Boer, the most formidable antagonist who has ever crossed the path of Imperial Britain. Our military history has consisted largely in our conflicts with France. But Napoleon and all his veterans have never treated us as roughly as these hard-bitten farmers with their ancient theology. That's Calvinism. And their inconveniently modern rifles. That's the Mauser 7.7s. And here we've got the monument to the bitter ender. The bitter ender, the one who fights to the very end. This you'll get at the Anglo-Boer War Museum in Bloemfontein. Others may have laid their rifles down, but not this man. His horse might be haggard, his clothes might be threadbare, but he's still in the field, and he's got his inconveniently modern rifle. And that's what Sir Walter Walker applied to the South African infantry in 1980s. He said, there's not an army in the world with as long or as intense or as high a standard of training as the South African infantry. He said, the South African infantry is the finest infantry in the world, bar none. And that was at a time just before we took on the Soviets and Cubans in Opsuper and Modula on the banks of the Lomba River. Now, I'd like to quote for Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, the generation now coming out of Western schools is unable to distinguish good from bad. Even the words good and bad are unacceptable. This results in impaired thinking ability. Now, if you can look past these six silly English girls here for a moment. This is a British classroom. Nelson Mandela, of course, communist, terrorist, idol of the New World Order. Che Guevara, dirty, unwashed, Marxist, mass-murdering thug, who boasted that he killed 7,000 people with his own hands. He was the one who did the execution. He is a hitman for Fidel Castro. Ran the concentration camps and also the firing squads. And, of course, Martin Luther King, perjurer, pervert, liar, Marxist. What do those three Marxist individuals have to do with education? Probably nothing, but they've got a lot to do with indoctrination. Marxists aim to demoralize the targeted victims by psychological warfare, or psyops, using guilt manipulation, vilifying the victims and victimizing the villains. The politics of guilt and pity seeks to undermine Christianity and nationalism. Another quote from Solzhenitsyn: modern society is hypnotized by socialism. It is prevented by socialism from seeing the mortal dangers. And once of the greatest dangers of all, one of the greatest dangers of all, is that you've lost all sense of danger. You cannot even see where the danger is coming from as it moves swiftly towards you. Socialism of any type leads to a total destruction of the human spirit. To destroy people, you must first sever their roots, which is exactly what the sermon this morning was all about. As our brother has told us, there is no doubt that they want to destroy us by destroying our understanding of our own history, severing our roots. Another quote from Solzhenitsyn: in keeping silent about evil, in burying it so deep within us that no sign of it appears on the outside, we're implanting evil, and that evil will rise up a thousandfold in the future. When we neither punish nor reproach evildoers, we are ripping the foundations of justice from beneath future generations. In our country, the lie is not just a moral category, it is a pillar of the state. He's talking about the Soviet Union at the time. The lie is not just a moral category, it's a pillar of the state. The timid civilized world has found nothing with which to oppose the sudden revival of barefaced barbarity other than concessions and smiles. Oh, and welfare benefits, of course. Under the duties required in the Ninth Commandment, the Westminster Larger Catechism lists the duty of preserving and promoting truth, the duty to stand for the truth and to do so from the heart, the duty to speak the truth and only the truth in matters of judgment and justice, the duty to speak the truth at all times, the duty to study and practice everything true, noble, lovely, and of good report. By the way, this is the gates of our parliament in Cape Town, South Africa. Under sins forbidden in the Ninth Commandment, the Westminster standards include the sin of giving false evidence. Your media, entertainment media and news media, and your textbook writers are guilty of giving false evidence. The sin of lying. The sin of concealing the truth. The sin of misconstruing intentions. The sin of exaggerating minor faults. The sin of perverting the truth to a wrong meaning. And boy, have they done that with South Africa and with the Confederate cause. Truth is truth, even if no one believes it. A lie is a lie, even if everyone believes it. Have you noticed the similarities between your country, America, and mine, South Africa? There's some intriguing similarities between our history. Shortly after Portuguese explorer Bartholomew Dias first landed on the shores of South Africa, 1488, the Spanish explorer, Christopher Columbus, actually, the Italian explorer working for Spain, Christopher Columbus, landed in the Americas, 1492, when he sailed the Ocean Blue. From the 1600s, both America and South Africa were settled by pilgrims from Holland, France, England, Scotland, Germany, seeking religious freedom. What was the first name of New York? New Amsterdam. Yeah, the Dutch found it and established it, and the British take it. They've done it before. Did the same with us in the Cape. While American pioneers were moving westwards in horse-drawn covered wagons to settle the vast, mostly uninhabited interior, the South African fur trekkers, or pioneers, were embarking on a great trek northwards and eastwards, also in covered wagons, but ours were drawn by oxen, not horses. Horses couldn't survive in our terrain because of the tsetse fly. Killed the horses like flies. So tsetse flies were the reason why we had to use oxen. Just as the American pioneers had to cross the Rocky Mountains, the fur trekkers crossed the vast Drakensberg Mountains. And as your pioneers drew your wagons in a circle to defend their families from hostile attacks, so our fur trekkers formed our lagers. Both South Africa and America had the gold rush, but we had a diamond rush too. And both our countries fought the redcoats. Both our countries endured a vicious war between the states. South Africa was even known as the Union of South Africa between 1910 and 1960. In our histories, we also find remarkable similarities between great Christian leaders of our two nations, the President of the Southern Republic, Paul Kruger, and his contemporary President, Teddy Roosevelt, were both far-sighted visionary conservationists who founded national parks, Kruger National Park being one of the greatest national parks in the world today. Our President, Martinus Steyn of the Orange Free State, and your U.S. founder, President George Washington, were both courageous Christian men of principle. By the way, Martinus Steyn said, when a politician declares war, he admits that they have failed, that we have failed. And he said, we cannot call other men and sons to go to fight if we won't go and fight ourselves. So I hand over to the head of the army, which was Christian De Wet, and I will fight under his orders without interfering, using my political rank to interfere with the generals. When it is time for peace to be discussed, then the generals can call on us politicians to sit at the table and help negotiate. But we will not interfere with the war until the end. Now, how's that for a man of principle? When last did you come across a president who handed over the military when he declared war and then fought under them? Martina Steyn also proposed the first act of the Union of South Africa be minting a half-cent coin with two sparrows on it to remind us that Jesus cares for the very least. Are not two sparrows sold for a single coin? Yet your Father in heaven cares for such as these. The Orange Free State General Christian De Wet, Virginian General Robert E. Lee were both outstanding strategists, staunchly principled men of God, much loved by their soldiers, even in the face of crushing defeat, and both were greatly respected by their enemies. You know, General De Wet ended up in prison in the First World War because he did not support South Africa joining the British in the war against their previous allies, Germany, for their previous enemies, Britain, 12 years after the concentration camps and scorched earth had slaughtered so many of our women and children. He said, "We have forgiven, but we have not forgotten the barbarities perpetrated against our wives during the war." So this man ended up in prison because he would not support Britain's war. Boer General Delarey and Confederate General Stonewall Jackson shared a boldness and bravery on the battlefields that inspired their followers to heroic achievements, and both died from friendly fire. General Delarey survived the war, but he was going to a meeting of soldiers who were wanting him to speak on why we shouldn't be involved in the First World War. September 1914, he is shot by our police at a roadblock. They said they mistook this most famous man of the country for a bank robber. A likely story. Shot by his own side after surviving a war. The military mistakes and the heroism of Custer's last stand were almost duplicated in the Battle of Isandlwana in Zululand. The courageous defense of the Alamo in Texas was also seen in defense of Rook's Drift in Natal. On these and hundreds of other occasions, the common ancestry, religious convictions, and similar conditions of South African American of pioneering days, at least, can be seen. Saving the colors of the Queen at Isandlwana. South Africans also fought alongside the American allies in the First and Second World War in Korea. But more importantly, we've shared a common Christian heritage and a missionary vision. South Africa is important in terms of minerals. It would be impossible to overemphasize the strategic importance to the industrial nations of the West or to the missionary enterprise of the church. We have some of the world's largest known deposits of gold and platinum and chrome and manganese, vanadium. You could not manufacture air conditioners, refrigerators, motor vehicles or jet aircraft, let alone satellites, without minerals you get in abundance in South Africa. Funnily enough, most of these minerals in South Africa, you can only get in Russia and South Africa. Between Russia and South Africa, we dominate the world's markets on most of these products. In terms of maritime, the Cape Sea route is the busiest in the world, with an average of 26,000 ships passing Cape Town every year, more than 30% of US oil imports, 50% of Europe's oil, 25% of Europe's food supplies pass around the Cape of Good Hope. You can just see what a phenomenally important coastline and choke point the Cape Sea Route is. When you look at it from the perspective of the Southern Hemisphere, it's a phenomenal ocean that we... When you look at your responsibilities, and then you look at South Africa's, look at the size of the... Naval responsibility of South Africa. It's a colossal amount of territory. Small navy, very small navy, but a big task, including rescuing ships when people are in distress, and they've rescued a number of ships. But our small navy has had to carry an important task. And our military, Pol PT, teamwork, poles, tires, and drums. Concrete pillars, ARPCOS, that's training for parachute training, concrete poles. You think, how long can you hold that up? A lot longer than you think you can. The amount of times you heard, ek kan nie meer nie, I cannot do it anymore, Corporal. But we did. And South African Army had the pain tame, or the pain garden, which is, you know, no pain, no gain. Rifle PT, buddy PT, crawling up and down, crawling under barbed wire, live fire training. Of course, got to overcome fear of heights. Musketry, we spent ages on, we fired thousands of rounds on the range. And of course, inspection. Funny how boys who couldn't get out of bed before could be up five, getting everything ready. People who couldn't make the bed before could now make it ready for inspection. Kids who couldn't polish your shoes. It's amazing what the army can do with some boys and what they could clean and the initiative. So I know these days they have what they call their gap year. Well, we had a gap 2 year, and that was in the army. Every South African had to spend 2 years in the South African army. And so military. But most important, M, is missions. Minerals, maritime, missions, military. South Africa is still the most important missionary-sending nation in the Southern Hemisphere. The South African churches continue to form the main missionary-sending base of all of Africa. South Africa is one of the most important bases for gospel radio broadcasts, for Bible translations, gospel literature production throughout the continent of Africa. One of the greatest missions in the world is Kwasi Sibanti Mission, run by a German missionary in KwaZulu-Natal. This is all a mission station. Phenomenal. Thousands of people here. Started by Reverend Erlo Stegen. This is one of the most phenomenal. It's a self-supporting mission station. Erlo Stegen, he has been preaching since age 16. He's now in his 80s. We celebrated a few years ago 60 years in ministry. The king of the Zulus, King Goodwill Zwelinthini, said, Erlo Stegen is God's apostle to the Zulus. He speaks better Zulu than I do. He speaks the best Zulu in Zulu. I learn pronunciation and diction and vocabulary from Erlo Stegen. Erlo Stegen preaches in Zulu. He can also preach fluently in German, Afrikaans, and English. And he often switches between them, which makes it really rough for his translator. To be a translator for Erlo Stegen is tough. But he is a phenomenal, powerful preacher against sin. They have ministers' conferences with 1,000, 1,500. Last time I went, there was about 2,000 ministers from something like 60 countries in the world there. Their school often wins the top awards in the country. They have conferences for parents. They have conferences for ministers. Erlo Stegen, still planting a new church, went with my daughter Andrea to evaluate his new mission field. He's in the Tugela Valley, and he is always, he's a farmer first. He gets the people to be self-sufficient farming-wise. Another great mission in Africa, back to the Bible Training College. This college has got over 100 students from 20-odd countries. At any one time, there are about 60 languages being spoken. And our mission is going all over Africa in order to run leadership training courses, Great Commission courses, teach history, plant schools, provide books. Our headquarters in Cape Town, Livingston House, we're just reading literature from all over the world. If you've got Bibles or books or school textbooks that you'd like to donate, you can send it. Florence, make sure we have a rodent-free environment. Bibles can be sent to us via a ministry called Eagle's Nest in Indiana. Just mark the boxes clearly. Peter Hammond, Frontline Fellowship, Livingston House. They'll get it to us in Cape Town, South Africa. They send us a container every month or two with about 18 tons of material. So they get it across the Atlantic if you can just get to Indiana. And then we have to get these Bibles and books all over Africa to one side or the other as far as Sudan. So I saw a few minutes ago the 5 minutes warning. Any questions, comments, complaints, or criticisms? Yes, sir.
If you won the war, then I guess you didn't win the politics.
No.
I'm wondering how influential was the media in the entire process of what South Africa has been through?
Yes. I mean, this is the whole point that I was putting there, that the military won the battles. The politicians gave away the country. I think your military know how that can be.
Vietnam.
You can fight the battles, you can win the battles, you can win the war, and the politicians hand it over to the same communist scum you just beat in the field.
Yeah.
It's called treason and treachery. And of course, the media plays a key role in demoralizing the people. or persuading them to, cheating them at the communists aren't very good at battles. They lose the battles, but boy, do they do well at lying.
Could you speak a little bit on the attempts to resist the handing over of power, like Eugene Terrebonne?
Yeah, there are different groups that do resistance. Right now, I'm a key figure in moving for the secession of the Western Cape. The Cape has been a political entity for more than 370 years, longer than the rest of the country. The Zulus recently celebrated 200 years of the Zulu nation. Well, the Cape's been around a lot longer than that. And so why should we not be independent? We've got everything we need. We're paying four times more in taxes than gets spent amongst us. We could halve our taxes, double our services if we just seceded. So as far as we're concerned, there's good economic and other reasons. We either go down with the Titanic or we launch out on our own. So the hope for the future is our government. If you want the full details, I've got a lot on the table of our Christian Action newsletters dealing with the farms and freedoms under fire and all these different battles we're facing right now. And it's important. There we go. If we get the literature, I'm producing frontline newsletters on our mission, on what we do, helping persecute churches. But we also write Christian Action magazine, separate mailing list. But this is for homeschoolers. It deals with history, Reformation. And so we're dealing a lot with the farms and freedoms under fire in South Africa, the false flags, subversion campaigns. Are we going into the second phase of the revolution? If you go on a frontline website, you'll get a lot of things, including a regular weekly From the Frontline radio podcast I do, dealing with these very issues, frontlinemissionsa.org. And we've got a lot of resources, quite a lot on the table there. But basically, if you're interested in our battle and would like to speak up for us and help put pressure on your government, put pressure on our government to stop trying to steal farms and murder farmers, we're heading in towards an attempt at genocide, which is why I produced this book earlier this year. And praise God that John Weaver wrote forward for us there. It's important that we know how to survive in South Africa. Every home is like a survival depot, and every farm has got to be a military bastion, because we're all under fire. We're surrounded, and we've got people who are singing from the government down about how to genocide us. So resistance is important.
What stage would you say the communist revolution is in our country? If you have any.
Well,
I know you're here,
well, praise God that you've got a maverick president who has derailed the Obama and Clinton agenda, and that's given you time to reorganize, because your country is being taken over the edge of the cliff. America's not quite yet at the stage of the first revolution succeeding. They're still preparing you for the first revolution. We're in the second phase of the revolution. The first phase of the revolution is political control. Now, your country is very decentralized, so that's harder for them. But once they get political control, they wait a few years while they consolidate, and then they come out with the second phase of the revolution. In our country, we're in the second phase of the revolution. For example, the French Revolution, first was political control. Second phase of the revolution was taking everything, farms, churches. And in Russia, the second phase of the revolution was the dekulakization, taking all the farms, Holodomor in Ukraine and so on. In China, it was 18 years after the revolution of the second phase, and that was the Great Cultural Revolution, Red Gods. You see, they need a new generation who didn't know what it was like to grow up in Tsarist Russia or in nationalist China or apartheid South Africa, or same in Zimbabwe. 20 years later, year 2000, they start the second phase of the revolution in Zimbabwe, take the farms. But it's not just farms. They're after churches, schools, everything, the culture. The second phase of the revolution is when they want everything. In America, they might be going the other way around, that they're trying the cultural revolution first, termite strategy, a la Gramsci strategy, in order to prepare for taking political control. In our countries, they've got political control first, then they're moving on the cultural revolution. I think America's more influenced by the cultural Marxism, and that's undermining things. You might still have a good political system of decentralization, but it's rotted because so many of the people are cultural Marxists, including in churches. Yes?
You talked about the small nation states in South Africa where language and cultural roots are separated. Is that still somewhat in effect?
Well, it is somewhat, because what we've got in South Africa is, because we've got 11 different language groups, the Zulus have their own king. And the Kingdom of Zululand has already said, if you want to take our farms, it's war. So we think the Zulu Kingdom and the Cape are probably going to be allies. Who secedes first, we're not sure, but we'll back one another up. So we're natural allies between the Zulus and the Boers. There's a very good alliance prepared there. I think there's others that will also break away. There's quite a few smaller groups that are looking at what's going on. They say, we don't want to be part of this. And so at the first chance, I think when one state breaks away, it's like Yugoslavia. Slovenia and Croatia broke away, and later you had Macedonia and Bosnia. So I think we're going to see a similar idea that when one breaks away, and it might be the Cape, it might be Zululand, but we're working very hard for it in the Cape. The trouble is, once we do this, the big, big, big danger is that the United Nations may try to invade us, like they did in the Congo. If you remember G. Edward Griffith, Fearful Master, Subversion Factor, what happened was when Moise Tshombe of the Katangan province, the southern Katangan province, seceded from the communist chaos of Patrice Lumumba's Congo, the United Nations invaded the Christian Katanga and destroyed it and forced them to rejoin the communist chaos of the Congo. So we want to secede in the Cape, and we've got the right to. If we can get a majority of our people to vote for it, and we think we can, legally, in our constitution, as there is even in the United Nations Bill of Rights, there's a right of self-determination of peoples based on shared language, culture, heritage, so on, religion. And we've got all that. And we've got every reason. We never were asked if we wanted to join the Union of South Africa. The British Empire forced us in. It's something we can blame on the British. A lot of things get blamed on him. And we never chose to give up our independence in the Cape. So I think we've got a very good legal case. But if we do take independence, there's a chance that some idiots in the UN and so on would want to declare war on us.
Yeah.
I've got a few ideas on this. We've got a few schemes on how we might get friends overseas, but we need friends of South Africa to be ready to speak up for us and to put pressure on your governments to at least do nothing to harm, but hopefully do something to support and recognize. But right now, we have a government in the African National Congress wanting to annihilate us. And I've got the newsletters there. You can read about second phase of the revolution. Cyril Ramaphosa speaking about, we are going to take the farms away from the whites and give them to our people.
That's done by Parliament, right? Parliament is...
They're trying.
Not quite done yet.
They've got to change the Constitution to do this. The Constitution, Section 25, guarantees the right of private ownership property and that the government has no right to expropriate land without just compensation by market forces. And now they're trying to change the Constitution, but that is not just for farms, it's for all property. It includes intellectual property, your cell phone, your car, I mean, any property. It's not just farms. Everybody's property, church property. I was at the event where they're having a parliamentary hearing where one of these creeps stood up and said, and it's not just the farms, we want the game reserves too. Well, in Zimbabwe, they looted the game reserves. They massacred the elephants. They slaughtered the rhino. They took the horn. Why? Because China wants the horn. I'm concerned that a lot of our farms, they don't want the farms to farm them. We know that.
Right.
They want the farms for China to strip mine and get the minerals out. Who cares about the animals and the people living on these farms? China's looting our continent. We are in a very dangerous situation. Our government is very much in bed with the Chinese. So we've got a serious situation going on. And, of course, we try and do everything we can to fight for it. The United States did a lot to betray South Africa into the hands of the communist terrorists who run the country now.
Right.
Therefore, the United States has quite a moral obligation to at least try to undo this damage, recognize attempts of ours to try and preserve law and order and all the rest of it in the farms. But they are talking about genocide. You've seen some of the pictures. Kill all whites.
I've seen it. It's on YouTube. We see it.
If you want to see...
We see a lot of disinformation also.
I'm sure there's a lot of disinformation. Now, a Canadian, Lauren Southern, secular person, has made a film called Farmlands, where she's gone and interviewed people. There's also Class Murder, made by Katie Hopkins, who's a British journalist. I don't know where she stands, but I think she's also secular on that. So you've got 2 one-hour documentaries that we've shared on our website. Now, we've got a Facebook page where we've put quite a lot of these things called Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism. Let's see, where is that? I think I've got Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism somewhere here. It's one of our key... I just started this year to try and have an alternative for news media. Ah, not there. HMS, School of Christian Journalism, is the website. And you'll see in our newsletters there quite a lot on the genocide being planned for whites in South Africa. Bear in mind, they've already killed 85,000 white people in torturous ways, in many cases, in the last 24 years, of which 4,000 are farmers and their family members. The situation's terrible, and they're literally talking about taking all land from whites, and they're talking about killing all whites. That's not something you should just laugh off in a continent where there have been massacres in the Congo, Rwanda, and all these other places. Yes.
Why Cape Town, because you gave example for Cape Town, why it's not on the top 10 of the biggest murders in the world?
Cape Town?
Cape Town is not in the first 10.
No. Well,
American cities are the first in the list of the biggest crimes. But you show Cape Town as a very, very dangerous place, as we understand.
I haven't said anything about Cape Town.
South Africa, it's very dangerous.
Well, South Africa's quite a lot of murder, yes.
The numbers of killing, comparing to United States.
Cape Town's actually better than most places in South Africa, but there is obviously quite a lot of targeting of the people, and a lot of violence going on in our country right now. The murder rates, I've got the stats, the murder rates are 25,000 a year. So, worldwide, your murder rate is 9 per 100,000. Every year, 9 people per 100,000 get murdered, on average, worldwide. Some parts of the world, like Sweden and so on, it's 1 per 100,000. Some place in England might be 6 per 100,000. In South Africa, the murder rate is something in the region of, is it 56 per 100,000? So it's about 6 times higher than national average, or international average. But a farm is 300. Per 100,000 per year. 300 per 100,000 are murdered every year. On average, that's farmers. That is twice the rate of police in the country. It's more than an American bomb disposal expert in Afghanistan or counterterrorism operational person in the military in Afghanistan. So our farmers, effectively you can say being a farmer in South Africa, white commercial farmer in South Africa, is the most dangerous occupation in the world today.
Comparing to black people killed during the apartheid.
Well, yes. Okay. Well, officially at the TRC, that's the TRC. I'm answering your question. At the TRC, Bishop Desmond Tutu and his people, appointed by Mandela, did an investigation, and they were able to, in 44 years of apartheid, identify 500 people who had been killed by the apartheid government. That would have been terrorists assassinated and so on. It was killed in riots and murderous situations. So they were able to put 500 deaths, extrajudicial deaths, down to the apartheid government in 44 years. And they admitted that over 18,000 had been killed by their liberation fighters, the ANC. So, plainly, when people are trying to compare, the average murder rate under Hendrik Verwoerd, for example, was something like 100, 160 a year would be murdered all over the country. Under Mandela, it was 25,000 a year. So, if you want to compare it, there's no comparison. There never was a case of whites singing, kill the blacks. There never was a case of government people encouraging people to go and kill blacks or take their land. In fact, very much the opposite. Whites were giving land to the black people under apartheid and building them schools and hospitals and everything else. The ANC were coming and burning down thousands of the schools that the whites had built for the black people, saying no education before liberation. So that if you were to say this is the reversal of apartheid, then they should be giving our own country and our own freedom.
You show how very good white people prepared the world for black people. So why they have to be separated? And why the black people weren't allowed to attend to white people's schools?
I think you've answered that very clearly. That's why I had you come. I believe Peter's answered it for me real well.
Well, there's lots of good news.
We got last one right here. Last one, then we're going to close because I know folks got to get on the road. Netta, go ahead.
Thank you so much for coming here and enlightening us with the problems that you're having. And I can relate to those problems because my mother is from Cuba. depending on the information where you get your news source, like about 4 or 5 years ago, the liberal media and the liberal president, our liberal president back then, was portraying the island of Cuba like a paradise.
Yes.
And the best medical that you could ever receive.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Unless you're from a country and you know better, I will tell you, they don't honor the elderly. You don't get good medical coverage. And they don't care if you die.
Media, I remember that.
And the food source is very little.
Indeed.
So if a country or news media portrays another country like paradise when it isn't, you have to know if you're from there to believe the people that are from a country that this is happening and it's not true.
Well, a key thing to me here is, where do people flee to? No one was shot in the back trying to escape from West Berlin to East Berlin. It was the other way. People aren't fleeing from Florida to go to Cuba. But over 3 million Cubans fled across the Caribbean to get... So, and throughout the worst days of apartheid, and my family were critics of apartheid. I'm from an English liberal family. So I personally was one of those people who criticized apartheid at the time. Although now I can see why we had it, and I could see it was better than what we've got, even though I was always a critic, and I'm on record as having condemned it in writing and speech. But even during the worst days of apartheid, blacks were fleeing into South Africa from free black majority rural countries by the hundreds of thousands and millions. Most black people in South Africa were not born in South Africa. Most black people in South Africa have come to South Africa because they've known they can get a better quality of life and high standard of living in South Africa than they can in the Congo, exactly. Nigeria, and so on.